Welcome back to Clinicians Brief, the podcast, the conversations behind the content. I'm your host, registered veterinary technician, Becky Musser. And this week's conversation is one of dermatology in nature, which is something that I know a lot of people struggle with in general practice. So we are very excited to have today's guest join us to have a conversation about non-blanching skin lesions. Today, we'd like to welcome Dr. Darren Berger. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm really excited to talk to you, and I'm going to ask you to give us a little bit about your background and tell us a little bit about where you came from, how you got here, and how you ended up at Iowa State.
So I'm originally from the state of Iowa, graduated actually from Iowa State University back in 2007 before going out into general practice for 2 years. Was fortunate enough to get a dermatology residency with dermatology for animals out in Phoenix, Arizona. Following completion of my residency, actually worked in private practice for about a year in Omaha, Nebraska, as a private specialty dermatologist on a referral basis in the Omaha area before coming back to Iowa State in 2013 when I joined the faculty as an assistant professor of dermatology.
And tell me, are you, first of all, one of the veterinarians who knew they wanted to be a vet their whole life, or was this something that came upon you in the later years?
I figured this out when I was, as an undergraduate, when I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do, realized I did not want to do human medicine. My wife is a pharmacist and thought it would be boring to do the same thing as my wife. Went out on kind of a limb and called a local veterinarian to say, hey, could I come on and kind of ride along with you and see what it is you do. And after my first day of doing that, I was hooked, and it was veterinary medicine from that point on.
Wow. Okay. That's pretty awesome. And I'm glad to hear that you got a yes for that. You know, can I go on a ride along? And at what point did you decide dermatology is the way you were going to go?
It was after I had graduated, after I had spent time in private practice, I realized I really enjoyed the dermatology cases from the standpoint of working with owners. And derm problems are one of those things we rarely get a great chance to permanently cure. Many times we're managing those things. And some of those long-term relationships I got a chance to build were some of the things that drew me to dermatology.
Well, I love that, because I think for so many of us, it's, you know, we're not in it for the people, and the, you know, spice of the everyday different things is what draws us to veterinary medicine, the variety. And I like that for you. It was kind of the consistency.
It was, and it was the chance to see things improve and to help people kind of more on a long-term basis rather than that one-off that really I found enjoyable about this profession.
Well, I know we're very grateful for folks like you, because when we look at your article, and this particular article was published in June 2019, Clinician's Brief, it's entitled The Top 5 Causes of Non-Blanching Skin Lesions. And, you know, I think in general practice, it can be a confusing space for a lot of general practitioners. And I think that they can get frustrated when we talk about different dermatology cases and trying to get to the bottom of things when we have lesions in our patients, they come in and we don't really know what's going on. So in this article, you discuss the top 5 causes, again, as it's titled, of non-blanching skin lesions. So tell us just kind of a rundown. What does that actually mean? Define non-blanching skin lesions and what they look like for us.
Kind of what it means, or kind of where it comes about, is many, as you already alluded to, many people have problems with patients that have dermatologic conditions. And many times that complaint is, my dog is red. And that's a common complaint we hear. That's a common complaint I know even when I was a general practitioner. Owners would call up saying, my dog's red. Is there something wrong? And many times the simple answer to that question is, well, yes, but it's not always that severe. Whereas sometimes that redness, or when it wants to non-blanch or go away with some light pressure, can potentially indicate some much more serious problems that indicate being seen on a more emergent basis.
So, you know, I guess for me, I don't necessarily think how concerning this would be. Like, how bad can that be, and how emergent are we talking?
So in the case of some of these conditions where we see some bleeding under the skin, something that may be seen with an autoimmune or condition such as immune-mediated thrombocytopenia, those conditions can become an emergency real quick, depending on how fast the platelets are being destroyed by the body.
Yeah, and you know, when we ran a poll with on the clinician's brief attached to this article, we asked the question, which of the following causes of non-blanching skin lesions have you seen? And the number one answer, actually, with 583 answers, was petechia and or ecchymosis from coagulation disorders. And so you're absolutely right. This is something we want to not ignore. And so I think this is an important message when we think about the entire team. Because sometimes these types of things get lost in messages, right? And when you call and you talk to a customer service rep at the front desk and you say, you know, well, I just kind of noticed this red area on my dog. I wonder if that's communicated and if there's a standard across the clinic that says, hey, that might actually be emergent. Let's get that dog in. Where do you think clinics stand with that?
I think you alluded to it. It's kind of a team-based approach, and it's getting all the members of your team on board in terms of filtering through some of those phone calls, whether it be the front-end staff or your lead technicians, of kind of helping discern from those chronic, itchy, inflamed, allergic dogs from those, my dog has been fine all of its life, and it has a problem that popped up immediately. Those type of discerning differences there are things that sometimes have to be worked through and just training people some of those key words or key things to pick up on. How long? When did it first start? Has there been any drastic change? You know, is your pet feeling okay? Those are some very important things to start asking through on the phone to determine how fast do I actually need to get this in to be seen.
Absolutely. And I love the premise of the article, kind of bringing that to the forefront of our mind and thinking about how important this can be and where we need to go once we have these lesions in our office. And so once they're there and they're in front of us, it can be difficult to kind of figure out the best order of tests we want to go about to figure out the exact diagnosis. And in this particular article, you talk about dioscopy to determine if lesions are the result of vasodilation having be, you know, an inflammatory process, or if it is that more concerning thing. So can you talk a little bit about and just sort of briefly explain dioscopy and how that's performed when in the practice?
So dioscopy is one of those tests that, at least in veterinary medicine, we don't use that often. And it's one of those things that I can even say going through vet school, I don't remember specifically anyone describing as a diagnostic. It gets used a little bit more in human medicine where you can find better descriptions of it in certain diseases and for which it should be used to kind of delineate or rule some things out. We look at dioscopy in terms of one of those things where when we get skin lesions, specifically erythemic or violaceous patches, plaques, or larger kind of areas where we have some concern, where we're trying to determine, is this just simple vasodilation in terms of just inflammation in the skin, or is there some pathologic process going on here where blood has left the vessels such that we see with petechiation of the immune-mediated thrombocytopenia diseases? Or is this just an allergic dog who's super red and has a hot spot here, where that's going to be more just kind of general vasodilation? The way that we go about doing this is just taking a nice clean glass slide that is clear, placing it on the skin with some light pressure, and does the skin directly under the glass slide kind of blanch out or get a white hue to it versus putting some light pressure and the color of that lesion doesn't change. With simple vasodilation, you should get the blanching out or the lightening up of the skin. With things such as bleeding under the skin or out of the vessels or other types of processes going on, that blanching doesn't occur. And it's when that blanching doesn't occur that our differentials or the things that we should start thinking about should change slightly at that time.
Okay, just to put you on the spot here, and no pressure at all, but this actually sounds like something a well-trained credentialed technician could be doing when they're taking the history for this patient and getting, you know, those baseline vitals.
I would agree with you there. I think getting your team trained to kind of help triage or think through the cases that are coming in the door can be quite helpful. Having a trained technician who, upon a presentation of someone bringing up or being concerned of acute onset of red blotchy patches, if the technician can perform the procedure or perform the diagnostic test and show that the skin lesions aren't blanching. This could help move the case kind of up the tree of importance to get it to the forefront of things that need to be dealt with maybe on a more immediate basis with the team in place that day.
I love it. Thank you. You know, technicians for the win for me always. But, you know, on a serious note, agree with you that if we know that this is something that could be underlying, kind of like you said, emergent, and what we know from the numbers from our poll, this is the most common reason we are seeing this. I love the idea of encouraging veterinarians to keep this as, you know, on the forefront of training their staff who are in the room initially with clients. For the reasons you said, we can push that up the tree of concern pretty quickly. So definitely appreciate that. And when we are in the room, say your, you know, support staff or your technician doesn't perform this diagnostic, or you happen to be the first one there, or it isn't something they thought of, you know, is this a first go-to diagnostic tool you're pulling out of your toolbox? How quickly are you going straight to this, or is there something else? And really, what's the difference between, you know, looking for just that capillary refill blanching with your finger and using that actual slide?
So I'll take that in a couple of parts. We'll deal with the first part, kind of that being, is it a go-to diagnostic? And I would say no, but in certain circumstances, when myself as a specialist, or I know other dermatologists, walk into a room, our list of differentials can be very different very quickly than the general practitioner. So when I'm teaching students and talking to students, even though we may want to jump to this a little bit sooner, it's kind of taking that step back and say, how do we approach this case from the word go? And many times we're going to start with some simpler things, whether it be skin scraping, trichogram, which is the process of just plucking some hairs, looking for fungal agents or parasitic agents, and simple skin cytology. After those things are sometimes acquired, then looking at an additional diagnostic such as this to help kind of whittle away those differentials, it can be very beneficial in that case. From the standpoint of the difference a little bit between just pushing on it with my finger or using the glass slide, a lot of times it's the different level of pressure. If I push hard enough on anything kind of with my thumb, I'm pretty sure that I can get it to temporarily blanch out versus that glass slide. There's kind of that, always that breaking point. I can only put so much pressure on that slide before I would potentially break it. And by no means when we're doing the procedure do we want to put that type of pressure on the slide. We want light pressure, and with simple light pressure, does it want to blanch out? And that's really kind of the difference of what the test allows us to do.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, and it really speaks to the importance. Now, we are going to get to the non-blanching lesions, but just one more question I wanted to ask. We do see blanching in this diagnostic. Are you confident it's secondary to inflammation and you go forward treating accordingly? Or are there other steps, you know, that you are going to be taking aside from ones you've already mentioned? And how do you further categorize there?
So that's a good question. I always try to avoid definitives, whether always or never. I always think there's exceptions to the rule. But I would say when things blanch and blanch with light pressure, it's going to make me feel a lot more comfortable that I've got kind of a vasodilation inflammatory process going on. Now, those, you can still have many diseases that are quite inflamed and are very concerning. But when things don't want to blanch, again, it kind of adds to this. It's putting me into a different category of certain diseases, and I'm going to start thinking about those things a little bit differently. When things don't blanch, I should say, we're going to go on to some further diagnostics that I'm sure we'll get into later during this conversation. But when things blanch, it kind of goes back to what we just talked about. We've got inflammation. Why do we have the inflammation? Is there any secondary infections? Are there any parasites present? Are there some things we can do with simple diagnostics to get owners answers kind of on a more financially responsible level?
That makes sense. And it is helpful to kind of know what we have to do and keep in mind the fact that we never always get to make that decision. I say never always, I put two of your extremes in one sentence. But you know, you're right, because it does come down to what we can do given the cost estimate and the constraints there. So, you know, we have to work within those parameters as well. And it's important to keep in mind. But, you know, going back, speaking specifically to your article, and we do have non-blanching lesions. You know, you outline in your article the five common causes, and one of those in the first being a drug reaction. And that really caught me, because the idea that this could happen days to even years after administration is incredible to me. And I just kind of wonder, how would you whittle that down when you're talking about those more extended types of reactions? And are there specific drugs that are going to have those more commonly?
Well, when we talk kind of about those reactions happening, most often they're going to occur shortly after, whether it be 1 to 2 weeks after starting administration of a medication. Rarely do they happen after the first or second administration. It does take some time to be exposed and to develop an abnormal reaction to the medication. In the case of administration over extended periods of time, I think it's important to remember, just because something's been given for a period of time doesn't always mean it's always going to be safe. And so that's one of those things that the great analogy I use is from one of my mentors when we even talk about just food allergies. One of the great kind of analogies is that you think about the 40-year-old adult who's eaten shellfish all of their life, but go out on their birthday to go celebrate, have a shrimp cocktail, and blow up like the Goodyear blimp. The same can be true for these dogs who have been on long-term chronic medications for a great period of time. They've tolerated them up to a point, but then all of a sudden they're having an abnormal immune event to the medication and are developing a reaction because of that. And so that time frame, in some cases, can be difficult to discern what is the inciting agent. When you talk about what things more commonly potentially cause these reactions, when we think about that, there's a couple of drug categories that always jump to the top of the list, that being antibiotics and non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. Those two classes of drugs tend to jump up a little higher in terms of things that at least pique our interest of things that could be causing the problem.
And you did mention the ethical concerns of chasing this down by readministering the drugs. And so if these are suspected classes or you do think that's it, sort of, how do you go about ruling them out without readministration being the way you go? How difficult are we really to say, bottom line, that's what it was?
In many cases, it can be very, very difficult to kind of confirm that the agent was the causative problem, because your suspicion makes you leery to prescribe that medication again. And many owners don't want to go through the process again, because that next exposure could be even more severe than the last exposure and potentially fatal. And I think we all have an ethical concern. Academic curiosity is one thing, but practicality and patient compassion and just being careful with the way that we treat patients is kind of overpower that more, oh, it'd be interesting to know for sure kind of philosophy that many veterinarians have. But from that standpoint, when we get concerned that maybe an antibiotic caused the problem, we would try to avoid that drug class or that drug family with antimicrobials or antibiotics. In the case of NSAIDs, it gets a little bit more difficult, because how different do the different NSAIDs really get? They're not drastically that different. Thankfully, compared to when I first graduated vet school, we have more pain-relieving medications, or we're using different medications that allow us some opportunities to get away from those non-steroidals and provide some of those patients some relief where we want to avoid that class of drugs altogether.
Yeah, I mean, it becomes a difficult space to work in, and it is always frustrating not to be able to say 100% that's what this is, and I think it's a space we work in a lot of times. When we're trying to decide what we're going to maybe pinpoint as the causative agent, or at least try to avoid in the future, what's that algorithm you follow for ruling out other causes that kind of narrow it down to one particular cause or another? How do you go about ruling things out?
I think the first thing is we go back to that basic skill that we all as veterinarians are trained, and that's acquiring a great history. I think most veterinarians can relate that there's the list of things the owners tell you they're giving, and then there's the list of things that they actually are giving. And those two lists don't always match up. And so it does take some time to tease out all of those things with a thorough history to find out what medications are being given, what foods are they eating, you know, what supplements are you actually giving, what preventatives are being used. And as you kind of whittle through that list, you try to piece everything together. And then we're always going to tier them in terms of drugs that have a bigger concern, again, those antimicrobials, those NSAIDs. And we'll kind of go down that list looking at all the possible options that could be the problem. Now, in many cases, we'll stop basically everything, including those supplements. we'll go back, look at the patient, we'll look at the list of things and say, what of these things are vital and what's worth trying to re-enter the mix or the fold for this patient? And we'll kind of go through those nutraceuticals, those vitamins, those supplements, we'll add those things back in. If there's a vital medication, let's say a dog with osteoarthritis, you know, maybe we'll look at, instead of going back to their NSAIDs, maybe we'll go to something like gabapentin. In the case of the antibiotics, we'll discontinue those. And then if we still need an antimicrobial, again, we're going to go to that different class. And so kind of that algorithm or thought process is trying to, if we have to reintroduce things, reintroduce the ones with the least concern, and then go up the list and try to maybe avoid or switch those drugs where the concern gets a little greater. In terms of trying to definitively diagnose it, the biggest thing is trying to rule out some other things. And drug reactions can look just about like anything. Sometimes they can show up and look like hives. Sometimes they can look like a nodular disease that might make you worry about tumors or fungal diseases, or they may show up as a crusting disease that might make us worry about pemphigus. So sometimes getting up to that biopsy to eliminate those other differentials as possibilities is a very important step in that whole diagnostic process to make sure that we're ruling out diseases that we could very much treat versus a disease or a condition that is avoid exposure, kind of suppress the exaggerated immune response, and then try to avoid having it happen again.
So now getting to the causative agent in the article, for just about every concern outlined for about the most all five of the common causes, you advise confirmation via biopsy. Is that correct?
We do. And the reason for that, again, gets back to no one of these diseases is 100% definitive just on a visual inspection. We may get suspicious of things. We may kind of become concerned about certain conditions. But a lot of times that biopsy is really required to either eliminate the other causes, so diagnosis by exclusion, or confirm the disease that we are suspicious of. The one exception to that rule is with the petechiation or ecchymosis in the case of hemorrhage under the skin. Biopsy in those cases, when that is the primary concern, would be a little bit contraindicated.
Sure. I mean, that makes complete sense. And I guess when we are looking at getting biopsies in these particular cases, what are the best ways to get good samples, and where in relation to the lesions do we want to make sure we're getting the best samples for these, you know, getting the answers that if we can get them?
There's a couple of different ways of going about getting a good biopsy sample. Many times practitioners want to sedate a patient thoroughly and take an excisional biopsy, which is a lot of times how people were trained to get biopsies of lesions. In the case of dermatologists, many times dermatologists don't sedate a lot of their patients unless the lesions are in a hard to get to spot, say the muzzle or maybe a foot pad or a distal extremity where we don't want the patient bouncing around, or we know those areas to be associated with more nerve endings where they tend to be a little bit more painful. Many times dermatologists are going to use a local anesthetic such as lidocaine to numb out a little area and then use a punch biopsy. And the big difference when using a punch biopsy sample is that we usually want to take all lesional skin. We don't want to take some normal and some lesional. We want all lesional skin to try and do the best that we can to get an answer. And when we're doing those punch biopsies, we want to take a good 6 millimeter sample. You want adequate tissue. And it's not always about getting a large sample, sometimes as much as it is getting several samples from multiple lesions, where there's going to be a spectrum of lesions on the dog. And to get the definitive answer, it may take a couple different samples. So sometimes the number of samples you can get is almost more important than getting one large chunk of skin. Those are things that we tend to take into consideration. Now, along those lines, one of the things we do when we're many times biopsying for the purpose of trying to get a diagnosis is we also sometimes biopsy for tissue culture. Again, proving that some of these conditions are sterile is one of those things we really want to look to do. And so not only are we taking punch biopsies for histopath, but many times we're taking punch biopsies for tissue culture as well.
And at that point in time, if we've gotten to the point where we are doing biopsies, are there any other recommended diagnostics we should be accompanying at that point?
If these animals are, you know, a lot of these conditions, the animals are either going to be older or they may be systemically not feeling well. And if we're going to be looking at starting long-term potential medications in the case of something like immune-mediated thrombocytopenia, where we're going to be on immunosuppressives for a long time, or something like epithelial trophic lymphoma, where we may be looking at chemotherapy or potential radiation therapy, getting that baseline blood work, that CBC, that serum chemistry profile, and your analysis to make sure the patient overall is in good health and is going to tolerate kind of our treatment option is another good diagnostic to get at that same time where we're wanting to get the biopsy so that we have all that information to present to the owners and give the best possible recommendations that we can.
It's not about hiring a good coworker, it's about hiring the right one. Post your open position on the Clinician's Brief Career Center to quickly get noticed by the right talent. With our platform and frequent promotions, we can help you connect with prospective coworkers and effectively grow your team. Post your job today at cliniciansbrief.com/career-center. Okay, and I think that really does bring me to my Keep It Brief segment, although no pressure, we rarely keep it too brief. But, you know, with the importance being of getting these biopsies and getting it done, how do you talk to clients effectively about these lesions when the origin is unknown in a lot of these cases? And how do you confidently convey to them, I don't know exactly what it is, but I need to find out?
Well, I think the answer to the question is kind of what you said. I think it's being honest with the owner. I think many times we as veterinarians are afraid to say we don't know, when in fact, that's exactly what we should say. We don't know exactly what the problem is, but we have a list of diseases that we're concerned about, and those diseases can be X, Y, and Z. And to definitively tell you what's going on, because these diseases are going to be treated differently, we need to do this test. And in the case of these non-blanching diseases, that additional test is either blood work, where in the case of petechiation or ecchymosis due to immune-mediated thrombocytopenia or diseases along that line, we're going to see changes in that blood work that we won't see with the other diseases. Where the other four, it's kind of that need for that biopsy. We have concerns of these diseases, but we're really going to need that biopsy to kind of tell us, to definitively be able to say, this is the disease and this is the treatment. Because guessing here in the case of these conditions could be extremely detrimental, because we may be doing one thing or one drug when we really should be doing the other. Or in the case of epitheliotrophic lymphoma, we're suppressing the immune system when we really should be treating it with various chemotherapeutic agents or other treatment modalities that would be in complete opposite of that of things like erythema multiforme or the adverse drug reactions.
And when we look at our poll results, the T-cell lymphomas were the number four cause that we saw. And so we know this is one of the most common causes. And when we looked at the poll results in general, between drug reactions, coagulation disorders, and lymphoma being high up in those answers, we know that these are things we need to get to the bottom to. And what I really appreciate is you kind of giving us a permission to say, I don't know, and feeling confident to look for further testing and to feel confident in saying further testing is what I need. At what point, just to kind of add on to this discussion, do you feel like we need to be referring to a dermatologist in these cases, or are these things comfortably done in-house and sent out for pathology?
I always kind of leave it to the practitioner's discretion. I always kind of use myself as an example when I'm talking to students about referring things. I think we all as veterinarians have things we enjoy. And when we enjoy it, we tend to be up on it. We tend to know what's new in the treatment area, and we tend to be comfortable with what it is we're doing. With the case of dermatology disorders, I think many things along the dermatology realm are things that many people can handle if they go through the process correctly. With that being said, if it's something you're uncomfortable with, or you're not quite sure, or, you know, I've never seen this, I've never treated it, I always think those are great times to either get a specialist involved or to refer to a specialist that you're comfortable with. I think, it's important to realize that referring veterinarian specialist relationship is kind of a mutually beneficial relationship. People should kind of think of it as an extension of their practice. They're going there to get excellent quality service And you want someone you can communicate with, because they can't always get back to the specialist, and they're going to be back into the general practitioner's office for a number of things. And so having that continuity of care and finding people you can work with and things that you enjoy or things you're just not quite sure about, that's a delicate balance for most individuals. And in my case, when I graduated, I was not a fan of diabetic animals, and I'm not the first to say that. Happy to diagnose them, but you want someone else to be regulating that, because that's just not where my interest was. And at the time when I graduated, there was a lot of change in the commercially available insulins, and keeping up on that became difficult amongst the myriad of other things that we have to do as general practitioners. So I think that's it's a loaded question, but I think it's something people always need to stop and ponder of, where am I comfortable? Where am I not? And yeah, I can't stress this enough. It's important for people to find people they're comfortable working with and referring their cases to, because again, it's an extension of you as a general practitioner.
Wow, you know, you make such a great point, right? Your clients are going to, who you send them to is going to reflect who you are as a practitioner. And you're absolutely right. And we are lucky that there are people like you out there willing to help work these cases up with general practitioners. And we are lucky that you're out there writing articles like the top 5 causes of non-blanching skin lesions that can be found in Clinician's Brief June 2019 edition. I think this is a really important topic to remember. This can be emergent, and we need to get to the bottom of these types of things. So I really appreciate you having this discussion and talking more about the importance of this conversation and taking the time today. If folks want to reach out to you, where can they find more information or reach out to you or get in touch?
The easiest way to get in touch with me is probably always via my email address, which is djberger@iastate.edu.
We appreciate it so much, Ian, and thank you so much for taking the time to be here with us today.
Not a problem. Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to today's guest for joining us, and thanks to you for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, you can find us wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. While you're there, make sure you subscribe, rate, and review. We appreciate if you leave us all the stars. You can listen to podcasts as well on our website at cliniciansbrief.com/podcasts. You can find us at facebook.com/cliniciansbrief. On Twitter @ClinicianSBrief and on Instagram @Clinicians.Brief. You can also drop us a line at podcast@briefmedia.com. Clinicians Brief, the podcast, is a Brief Media production, produced by Alexis Ustry, sound by Randall Stupka, hosted by me, Becky Mosser, with special thanks to production assistant Michelle Moncrez.